Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July the 30th, 1999, and in Quinania Fireside Room this morning, we have Ann Peterson, an Enigma of Variations, Facing Evil, number 99-9. Let's listen in.
Some of you are coming for the first time, some of you for the third, fourth time. And I will begin by a little review and an introduction. My name is Ann Peterson, and I teach religion, or actually theology, at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And today's session in particular, I think, raises sticky and difficult questions about the overall theme for the week, which is rooted in the question, where in the world is God? That issue, where in the world is God, is a large question about how we understand God's role in the world. The first day, we took a look at that question, kind of looking at questions of diversity, of otherness, of pluralism, questions that we face sort of in our modern world. The second day, we looked at how do we understand or where in the world is God related to questions of science and technology. Yesterday, we raised questions about, what was yesterday? Oh, geography, sort of looking at landscape. I'm sorry, I'm getting a little forgetful. Yesterday I was looking at what we call the geography of faith. And today we'll look at the problem of evil. This question, I was just talking to Jim, goes back, I think, to the, well, it's rooted in anybody who's believes in some sort of a reality larger than themselves. You have to think about questions related to suffering and evil. But it became a theological problem for me, I think, the first time I read Luther. And I started reading Luther in high school, and really, I think, felt some sympathy for Luther's questions about not did God exist. That's never been the problem for me. I've never really had a crisis of faith about whether or not God existed, but the crisis for me has been what kind of God existed. Who is this God that we're in relationship to? That's really been my own personal struggle, and I think Luther as well. So that question remained with me through college and through seminary, and then finally in graduate school, I wrote a large part of my dissertation related to the problem of evil as it related to Luther. So today, the whole goal of this session is to explore how the problem of evil presents serious obstacles for the believers, poor believers, not just the, that's probably in this place where they're, about the nature of faith and the presence of God's action in the world. And just a little note about the title of Enigma Variations. I said earlier that this is variations on a theme. Each of the chapters or sessions out of this raises the same question, where in the world is God, but with a little bit different variation. And I've used musical forms to explore all those. We've had dissonance and scherzo and yesterday three-part invention. Today, the Enigma Variations. Anybody know where that comes from? What piece? What composer?
Elgar.
Exactly, yeah. Edward Elgar. Wonderful piece that I would highly recommend to all of you. Elgar is most famous for his Pomp and Circumstance. If you go to graduation, you've heard Elgar. And he has this piece called The Enigma Variations, which actually doesn't have anything to do with the problem of evil. Though the piece itself is a typical romantic, it's rooted in the romantic tradition, but it's very, it's full of emotion and pathos and, I think, depth. And it really somehow expressed to me kind of the perplexity of the human situation. It's also just beautiful music. So someday when you're out at the local CD store, pick up Elgar's Enigma Variations. I thought of the twist on that word enigma because, you know, I did my little word check on the computer. You turn on your thesaurus and type in enigma and you get all kinds of words. And I listed three on the board and two of them are on your sheet that come up when you get to the word enigma. One is puzzle, secret, and the word impasse. Yeah, which I thought was interesting, isn't it? Dilemma was another one. So I started doing some playing around with what those words might mean in relationship to evil, because I've studied, read, thought about evil for my whole career, and it's still an enigma to me. I have strategies now for how I think about it and how I'm sort of resolved with what I do with it. But anytime it presents itself in a new way, whether I read about it or experience it, I always get kind of thrown back again to the place of being in an enigma or puzzled. And I finally decided that that's what one should be. I'm getting less satisfied with, and we'll talk about this more later, the traditional approach to the philosophical problem we've called the problem of evil, which has tried to come up with nice, compact, clear philosophical resolutions. I'm not terribly comfortable with those. I think they're helpful because people need to work through their intellectual issues. On the other hand, I think there's something about keeping evil, letting it somehow press our lives as a puzzle, impasse, or dilemma. It's a puzzle in large part because it raises lots of questions. It raises questions about the nature of human beings. It raises questions about the nature of God. And a quote from Wendy Farley, whose name I've listed up there, she said, "No conceptual scheme can thoroughly expel the bewilderment that suffering and evil evokes." So you can't sort of finally answer it. She said, "The phenomena of human suffering continues to bleed through the explanations that attempt to account for it." And I kind of like that. You try to rationalize it, you try to explain it, but the pain of suffering and evil in its radical state just sort of keeps seeping through. Evil as an enigma, as a secret. Some of the worst kinds of evil that I've either known through friends or experienced or talked to people about or read about, Nancy Romanoff's biography up there has one of my novels that I use in class. It's a book called Bastard Out of Carolina. I've mentioned it in a couple other sessions, by a woman named Dorothy Allison. How many of you have read that? Put it on your to-read list. It's not an easy or pleasant book to read. Easy in the sense of what it presents you with. It's about a young girl named Bones, and she grows up in the South, and it's the relationship with her stepfather that is incestuous. And, of course, the terrible thing about the evil in that is that it's a secret. Evil which somehow hides the perpetrator and blames the victim, in which you can't tell what's going on, I think is another sort of insidious form of evil. So evil is a secret for me. Is how do we make public that which we've concealed? That happens in all kinds of situations. Why is it that we try to cover up, in many ways, gloss over, make pretty, not deal with the evils that we've committed? Finally, the word enigma as impasse or dilemma. That was helpful for me because I think traditional resolutions, again, to the problem of evil, lead one to an impasse, to a dead end, to a place where you can't sort of work your way out of it. And I'm not saying that those aren't helpful, but they do sort of, I think, they're not satisfactory for a number of reasons. So that's just a little brainstorming about what I think the roots of the word are with puzzle, secret, and impasse. So what I'd like to do is start this session first out of your responses to the question, and I have some other things I'll add toward the end. But I'd like to begin by asking you what you think evil is. By either definition, by experience, by a story, by an event. How do you know when you find something evil?
We think of evil as being a crime,
okay,
a murder.
Okay. What happens that would make it evil?
The death of a person.
Okay, so the death of a person, taking somebody's life? Yes.
Just thinking of the apocryphal story of Tobit, and there's this woman that she keeps getting married, but her beaux keep getting killed off in the middle of the night by this demon that comes flying in. Had a little word study, we found out that this demon's name was the dissembler or the shredder. And I think of evil, and I think of that which shreds, that rips apart.
those are good words. They're very descriptive, aren't they?
Good.
Yes.
I think of evil as being confusing or just I can't understand.
Okay. Perplexing, can't understand it. Yes.
When evil has been perpetrated on me, or I've done evil, my core experience is that I question my very sense of who I am. Or when I'm unkind to my son, mm-hmm. I see on his face, really wondering who he is and that it's not good.
Okay, so it raises, it sort of questions human identity.
Yeah, or value.
Okay.
Value.
Okay.
Objectifying. And I mean, I know my 10-year-old son would say that he's been told, maybe not in words, but made to feel like he's a bad person.
Okay.
In the very center. And I know that when others have been evil to me, I feel bad, inadequate, not enough. And that feels real primitive to me.
Okay.
Real basic and inside me what's happened.
Right?
Yeah. This is not a definition.
No,
it
doesn't
mean. I feel uncomfortable sometimes with the word evil and how it's done about.
Okay.
And I think sometimes the very people that are calling things evil are, I question them,
mm-hmm.
their motivation. And I'm thinking of cultist movements that mm-hmm. appear to be or pretend to be good and
mm-hmm.
And yet, if you got down to the core of that person or that movement, you would see that it's not good. But to me, I think we use the word evil too easily.
Okay.
I would say that things can be problematical and things can be awful,
mm-hmm.
but they're not necessarily
evil. Okay. Mm-hmm. So maybe what we want to get at during this session is the difference between something that's problematic and something that's evil.
Rational versus evil. Or, you know, there are a lot of things that we don't understand, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're evil, but I think we put that label on it very often. When I think evil, it's Satan is evil, it's against God, you know.
Okay, well, there's some helpful words.
How about dreadful?
Okay.
Frightening.
How about controlling?
Yeah.
Possessive?
Sure.
Because right now I had an experience with an 18-year-old that says she's full of evil.
Hmm.
And that's really hard to deal with. And I think of how it possesses her and how it's controlling her. But the power of God is now beginning to work within her, and it's beginning to come out and be controlled by God and by Christ and by her faith.
Okay, so two forces at opposition even with each other. Luther used the descriptive metaphor of humans being like a jackass, and you don't know which person is riding the saddle, Satan or God. It's very descriptive. Yes, here first and then
Sometimes thought of evil as being the distance or the gap between what some people might consider ideal versus what is real.
Sure.
The shortfall.
Okay, so it's,
what's
Romans, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Yeah, so it's a shortfall between what is and what might be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah.
Right. Evil is turning stones into bread, casting oneself off the pinnacle to be scooped up by God's angels,
mm-hmm.
and bowing down to something in order to have dominion.
Okay.
Whatever we do to prove our own worth becomes the essence of our evil.
Okay, so finding your self-worth in other temptations and other sources of power other than rootedness in God.
How virtuous they may have.
Okay, that's helpful. And I'm going to come back to that virtuous affinity. Yeah.
There's also a certain sense with evil, though, that it's hard to describe, but you can almost sense it or feel it or taste it, that it's got this life of its own.
Okay.
That it kind of goes, whoa, and people stand in awe almost of how
okay, maybe it kind of an ill. And again, both of you are using language of power.
Okay.
Yeah, Jim?
What would good be without evil?
Okay, so contrast. That's one of the classic definitions. Is that in order to know good, we have to know evil. Okay. All right, that's the whole aesthetic tradition, yeah.
Following on what Wes said, for me, evil feels it's menacing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, assaulting and menacing, it's not a benign, like being bad, like you said earlier, it really is assaulting.
Okay. Several of you have said it has its own power, its own sort of force. Yeah, Luther uses the language of seduction, that evil is seductive, and often what happens in evil, and Luther says this is the most frightening kind of evil, is that we can't distinguish evil from good. His language that he uses has, at this point in our life, I think dangerous racial implications. What he talks about is that what looks like the white Christ to us appears actually is hidden as the black devil, and we can find other ways to talk about that. But that what appears to us as Christ is actually the devil working in the form of Christ. And sometimes the things that seem most appealing, most good, most wholesome are actually in their seduction and their power evil. But they appear to be good.
Yeah. The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Right, exactly.
Or C.S. Lewis, the Screwtape Letters.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The caricature of the church lady.
Yeah, right.
Isn't that special? You know,
yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's
going on.
Right. And Santa, of course, always appears in the same letter. Says Satan. You know, she gets those little words turned around. Some of you may remember the church lady. She's one of my all-time favorite characters. Yeah, Jim?
I think about evil as a force.
Okay.
And I think that for us, like, as enlightenment creatures, it's hard for us to acknowledge that or to admit that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think about it as a force that only has power when it is able to seduce us and act in such a way as to destroy the dignity of other things God has created.
Okay.
When we get to the distinctions between moral and natural evil, I'm not big on the concept of natural evil.
Yeah, see, I want to talk about that too. I think in the traditional philosophical categories, you kind of list it. But whether it's intrinsically evil or not is real problematic, I think.
Yeah, it's more problematic. I mean, what nature does to other creatures is
right.
More problematic than it is evil.
Right, exactly. And that might be that distinction we want to talk about. Destroying something's life force and whether it contributes. And then, of course, we haven't even gotten into the discussion of whether something's intrinsically evil, that is absolutely no good in it, or whether it's what you can call instrumental evil, that which contributes to a greater good, but maybe good in the long haul, but initially evil. Jan?
Elie Wiesel has spoken on our campus a couple of times,
mm-hmm.
and this quote may be famous, so you'll have to revise it. I'm not sure how it went, but he said that the greatest thing to fear is not evil, but indifference.
Mm-hmm.
So that gave evil a new face.
Well, it does give it a new face, because I think we're all part of that. That, I mean, I've used this example maybe too many times this last week, but going to Dachau again was part of this experience of seeing what Wiesel talks about, because it's so easy to say, how could those people living in Dachau do that? Weren't, you know, well, I don't think I'm a bit different. I'm not sure that I would have come out of there whole lot different, because I live in a state that has the highest poverty rate for Native Americans in the country. So it's really easy to keep saying, how could somebody else do that, when in fact indifference, other theologians have picked up on that language of indifference. You're either on the side of the executioner or the executed. There's no middle ground anymore. And I think Elie Wiesel comes out in that same kind of language.
He tells the story of the people being herded into the square, the Jewish people being herded
mm-hmm.
in. And that he could understand the guards,
mm-hmm.
and he could understand the Jewish people, but he tells the story of a man watching through
the right, through mm. his curtains.
With an impassive face that shows right. no, and he said, well, that's the face he can't understand.
Yeah.
Well, that's the face that after the war, as a grown man in the novel, he goes back to him and asks, how could you watch? How could you take that stance?
Yeah, that's
that was the worst for him.
Right. I'm going to offer just a couple little readings. I haven't finished a book since I've been up here. Probably brought like 50 books with me, which is a good sign, right? So one that I've been reading that I do this sometimes to my own detriment, I hear that a new book is out, and the only way I know I'm going to read it is if I teach it. So I order it without ever having looked at it, and then read it over the summer and begin using it. And I was hesitant with this one. It's Annie Dillard's new book, For the Time Being. It's gotten not very good reviews. I mean, the reviews I've read it is that this is not Annie Dillard at its best, which is probably true, though I've decided reading it now that Annie Dillard at her worst is still better than a lot of people at their best. I wanted to just share a couple quotes from you. We've been talking a lot about evil done to human beings, evil perpetrated by human beings, which in philosophical categories is what I listed up there as moral evil. And in theological categories, that translates into sin. And she comments here as an example of what she lifts up in her little section called evil. Killing people by scraping their flesh from their bones was an idea that lived. In the 5th century, Christians killed the well-born lady Hypatia. According to Gibbon, in a church, they stripped her flesh with oyster shells and threw the shellfuls of flesh quivering into a fire. Her problem was Neoplatonism, says writer Hal Crowther. Also, she had studied mathematics. After this, comments Bertrand Russell, Alexandria was no longer troubled by philosophers. A little sarcasm, right? But evil done on both sides, right? Here the church, there's a journal now of feminist studies called Hypatia. It's a wonderful journal in honor of this I think now saint that the Christians persecuted, and of course that kind of evil happens on all sides, and we still have it in the U.S., but I was just overwhelmed with the sense of killing that had gone on in the name of religion. You get a little history of it in this country, but when I spent a month, now I've been spending months in England periodically, and that history is just filled with one story of the Protestants killing the Catholics, and the Catholics come and kill the Protestants, and then the Protestants kill other Protestants, and the Catholics kill other Catholics. And how many of you have seen the movie Elizabeth? I couldn't get the opening scene out of that movie. In fact, I had nightmares for weeks. There's an opening scene in which these three people, they're Protestants in this case, though it reverses it later, are being led off to be burned at the stake. And it's a very violent, I think one of the most violent scenes I've ever seen in a movie, because it's so graphic in its recollection of what's happening to these people. So moral evil, and I like the way Jim started that, a lot of you have put that together, that evil does something to people's worth, to their value. It can diminish it in how one feels, the example you gave, or it can obliterate them. So evil is really destruction of human life at its rawest, and that's moral evil, and again in the theological category of sin. Okay, another quote from Dillard.
Yeah. But I don't think we want to be anthropocentric and just limit, you know, the expression of evil to what it does to other human beings. I was trying to say that whatever destroys the dignity
of anything. Created, okay.
Maybe there's still levels of evil there, and maybe the destruction of infants and children is more evil than the destruction of the wanton destruction of creatures that aren't human. But I wouldn't want us to limit evil.
No, I agree with you. And I think maybe what you're saying is probably even important, because traditionally moral evil has been limited to the destruction of humankind. And if you open that up to humans' destruction of anything which has value and worth. I just sort of cringed yesterday when Barbara Rossing talked about the 3,000 cattle that had been destroyed in the feedlots from, you know, dying of thirst. Or the stories that you hear about people tormenting animals, and, you know, or the kind of destruction that we're doing to the environment, all those things in which there's purposeful destruction I think, raises some interesting questions, because that's different than the next kind of evil I want to talk about, which we've traditionally put under the category of natural evil. So to broaden that discussion about moral evil as being anything that humankind does that destroys the worth and dignity of life itself. And of course, we can get into all kinds of discussions about, I think it would take another 2 weeks to really sort of understand what we mean by that. Because it seems like you commit some moral acts in order to justify a greater good, and there's all those kinds of questions that we could get into. Annie Dillard has another little section in here about evil, and this raises the question of what we might call natural evil. I'll link metaphysical evil to it. Metaphysical, I mean by the way the world works, by just the fact that the evolutionary process has led to all kinds of destruction, and how many millions of species have died off in order for other species. I mean, it's pretty clear that in order for new life to happen in the ecosystem, death has to occur. And some of it's pretty violent. So she talks about the following. She, in the beginning of the book, she has a large section on children that grow up with various kinds of genetic mutations. And she goes into very graphic detail about these children that she calls dwarfs. So she says, what then of the bird-headed dwarfs? It need not craze us, I think, to know that we are evolving like other living forms, according to physical processes. Statistical probability describes the mechanism of evolution, chance operating on large numbers, so that, as the paleontologist said, at every moment it releases a given quantity of events that causes distress. That is, evolution's every success is necessarily paid for by a large percentage of failures. Okay? In order to live at all, we pay a mysterious tribute of tears, blood, and sin. It is hard to find a more inarguable explanation for the physical catastrophe and the suffering we endure at chance from the material world. Okay. So, the question that we might want to think about, and we won't take a long time with it, but these two have often been listed as evil, and the question is whether they're intrinsically evil. Tornadoes, floods, that thing's right at things. Is evolution somehow evil? Now, I suppose the question that raises at a larger issue for me and is nature itself friend or foe? I mean, I think that's an important question to raise, because in the creation stories, we're somehow told, right, that God makes everything and calls it good. So I think we have to figure out how we deal with, theologically, the question of natural and metaphysical evil. I'm not going to offer any big suggestions today, other than to say it may not be helpful to talk about evolution as evil. That's problematic. I mean, when one species eats another species, probably isn't too good for the species that got eaten. But it does seem to be the way the world works. It's a strange combination of law and chance, and that through the evolutionary world, millions of species die off in order for the next species to survive. That's
that raises an interesting question then, in terms of the human species.
Mm-hmm.
What would be evil about the human species dying off?
I'm not.
And, you know, then the question is what we do to each other part of the natural process?
Well, a lot of arguments have been made exactly that way.
Well, sure, but I mean, if evolutionary process is not evil, but only problematic, why is there a differentiation between, say, the destruction of the dinosaur and the destruction of humanity?
Well, the Nazis, their take on that was that they were purifying the race, and
right,
they were doing a favor.
But it's all part of the natural process.
That's how they languaged it, yeah.
Well, no, I'm saying if we grant the other, why do we grant something different to human, to the human species?
Well, I think there are distinctions. I mean,
right,
we clearly, most people feel differently when their pet dog is killed than when they step on a at. I mean, there are distinctions. And I don't know if that's right or wrong, but we do have an implied hierarchy of value.
Aren't most of the major extinctions that have taken place over the course of natural history precipitated by either major geological events or the collision of meteorites with the Earth?
Right.
And they're not necessarily a consequence of choice as part of living creatures.
Right.
So that's...
That's a little bit different, and I think evolution is not one smooth, we've learned that it's not a smooth passing on, it's been punctuated. Now they're talking about punctuated evolution where these large movements of extinctions happen.
There are differences that we know.
Right. And that's been the whole conversation about the evolution of humans, is that we're conscious of what we're doing, and with that comes a different ethical response. I mean, my dog has different ethical responsibilities than I do, right? And I think that works in terms of how we live with children. I have a different moral responsibility than a 2-year-old does.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And that whole sense of menace, too, mm-hmm. or deliberate mean-spiritedness,
mm-hmm. yeah.
is not true in evolution.
Right.
Is evil anything except in the mind?
Well, that's...
And it sure seems to be. I think what happened... I couldn't tell who said that. Oh, up here. Somehow what happened in Dachau seemed to me more than somebody's imagination. Right?
Well, I'm not talking physical acts versus... Somebody had to have an evil mind or whatever. I don't think animals can have an evil mind.
Oh, okay, I see what you mean. That somehow evil maybe is a category that only belongs to humans. Okay, so it comes out of intentionality, and maybe Jim's larger, so amplifying the category of moral evil to include what we do to nature might be more helpful than the old distinction of talking about moral and natural evil. So I think in that way what you're saying is that the evil that happens comes out of moral conscious intention, and it may happen to nature, but it's not nature itself.
It's kind of like Annie Dillon said in one of her other books that God doesn't do these things. It's man's act or
right.
life
mm-hmm.
with God.
Right. Yeah, I think that's helpful. Yes?
Don't you think, though, in some sense, we're altering the natural course of our world by so-called global warming,
mm-hmm.
That these storms that arise now that wouldn't have arisen had we not screwed around with things?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, what's to say we aren't going to go the way the dinosaurs did?
Right. Oh, I think you're absolutely right. One of the words that theologian uses is that we can no longer talk about nature as nature. There is no part of the natural world that's not somehow pervaded by technology and human intervention. So he uses a lot of categories of techno-nature. And that's precisely what you're saying, right? Yes.
Is the nature that we're seeing, though, the nature that God had intended it to be?
Probably not.
No, and I think even within, there's a whole Pauline sense that, this is sin, the rebellion ripples throughout the whole mm-hmm. of the created order.
Yeah.
It was struck because we were talking to a 5-year-old about the fact that, well, when God comes back, when everything is put back in place in the kingdom, all that was dead will be, well, poor Carl was terrified because of the Tyrannosaurus. I'm so into that.
Yeah.
Also, we don't want that back again.
Right.
But there's the sense, too, that when you read the biblical record, when they talk about the kingdom, all of a sudden you have lions eating straw.
Mm-hmm.
There's
yeah.
this image that shifts a little bit and says, well, maybe things aren't quite right now what they were meant to be.
Somewhere somebody told me that in certain rabbinic myths that before the fall of Adam and Eve, humans were vegetarians.
Right.
That after the right, yeah. And
Genesis 1 and 2 is the...
And you might help me with this, but in Genesis 1, 2, and 3, the word evil or sin, it never appears as far as I know. And of course, that's the classic story of the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first time that the word sin appears is in Genesis 4, when God confronts Cain who killed Abel and said, sin is crouching at your door, you must master it. But I don't have the words exactly right, but I think it's Genesis 4:7. So that's the first time that the word sin is used in the biblical narrative. And I've read a couple scholars who talk about what happens in Adam and Eve is really a prelude, that the fall is what happens with the killing of the brother, the killing of humankind. So the disobedience is the prelude to what happens in the killing, because that's where the word sin is actually used. It's not so much that somebody ate the apple and got too smart or something, but it's in the killing of the other that we need to talk about what sin is. And that's really our moral dilemma for the century. Yeah, Jim?
I just want to come back to the discussion we were having about death and life. On the one hand, Christianity understands ecology, that from death comes life. That's mm-hmm. the whole notion of death and resurrection.
Right.
But on the other hand, Christianity, it's almost resurrection to a life somewhere else than mm-hmm. here. And we also have a fundamental theological issue with death. Paul writes, the wages of sin are death.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is that true? Human beings are you know, latecomers on the evolutionary scene, creatures that lived and died for millennia, and from their death came new life.
Mm-hmm.
Are we really any different from other creatures in that regard? And so one of the challenges that the modern understanding of ecology is presenting to, I think, Christian theology mm-hmm. is for us to grapple with our understanding of death.
Yeah.
Huh. And that's one reason why in bioethics we cling so tenaciously to the last 6 months of life and rack up these humongous bills
right.
and fight death at all costs and stave it off with technology because we're so afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at the same time, you know, ecologically speaking, it's
part of who we are.
You are dust, and to dust you shall return.
Right. There's a wonderful, and I'll just jump in before I forget this, there's a wonderful reference in Arthur Peacock's book, Theology for Scientific Age, which takes on exactly what you're saying, and he takes on that Pauline quote saying that we can't now, knowing what we do, interpret the wages of sin as death in that kind of way, because death was clearly here before sin, and so we have to rethink those categories. So you're absolutely right about that. Yes.
I'm just thinking of a book by Ernest Becker, which introduced me to the idea that the basis of all fear is fear of death.
Yeah. Is that denial
all
of death?
That exists. A comedian.
Yeah.
Freud sort of got us off the track and mm-hmm. sexual drives and things, like he said, really underneath it all is fear of death.
Annie Dillard quotes Ernst Becker all over the place, and I haven't seen it used for a while again. I think that Becker's work is coming back. It was real in vogue when I was in college in the 70s, and it's coming back. Yes?
Well, I mean, to follow up on what Jim has said, too, I mean, if we go back to your earlier understandings of what are synonyms for mm-hmm. evil, no, one of the synonyms for evil was not death. And I mm-hmm. think that sometimes, and might be interesting to think about exactly when we've decided that death is synonymous with evil.
But
I think even there, and to take it one step further, it's a notion that often finitude is considered synonymous
right.
with evil. And I think that's tremendously problematic because mm-hmm. when Paul says the wages of sin is death, I don't think he's saying that we should equate evil with notions
right.
of finitude. I'm not even sure it's an appropriate Pauline understanding to say that evil and death should
mm-hmm.
be synonymous. And
no,
so I think that it's when we make those kinds of equations that we have a very skewed theology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Those are really helpful comments. Hand back here, and then we'll get over here. Yes?
Is sin synonymous with evil?
Well, that's right. I have somewhere in the back on other lists is sin synonymous with evil, and is suffering the same as evil? And, you know, I think they're really important distinctions that take a lot of thinking through what those mean. Yeah. Yes?
I don't know which volume of Luther's works on that, but he's got two on devotional writings. And in one of them, he talks about death as being the greatest evil.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that people are willing to exchange all kinds of other evil big on all other evils to avoid that one evil. And I think his idea is that death challenges the goodness of God. And so it's really the last onslaught of Satan, or however you want to talk about that, to pull us away from God.
Right. And death in that kind of language is different than end of life.
But it is, in a sense, a very terrifying thing. And I think I used that quote. We had a 23-year-old daughter who was killed in a automobile accident. And for her memorial service, I started that. For a funeral service, started off the service, you know, in the bulletin with that quotation. Because I think it is, it impacts us so dramatically that it you wonder, I mean, there's the natural process, we all die, but then there's the interruption of the natural process. And I think that then becomes an onslaught of other words that have been used, for example, shredding or separation. That demon in COVID, by the way, became a housewifel for Luther, in which he spoke of that lurking around in families.
That's interesting.
COVID.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. Yes?
Well, I was just thinking about, I don't use evil and death synonymously, but I think the greatest fear about death is the fear of the unknown, and there's no one that can ever explain that unknown to us, unless it would be a theological term. Or, you know, we talk about separation of God and God's love and salvation and all that. But, I mean, the death itself is always going to be an unknown experience. No one here can tell us about it until.
Sure. There's that fear.
And I think that's why it's the greatest fear.
Yeah. And I've heard death, part of the evilness or fear of death or something, also Alfred North Whitehead described the ultimate evil as loss. You know, and that's sort of what you're as loss. And that grew out of his own life history with having a son killed in World War I and watching a whole generation of young men in Britain wiped out because of the war.
I'm not certain that fear of death is the greatest fear for everyone. I think it may be fear of suffering.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I have to quote my father, who when he hit his 90s started saying, "I want to die, I'm not afraid of death, but I don't know how to do it." And what he meant was, how much more suffering am I going to have to go through? How will it be at my end, you know? Can it possibly be worse than this? I mean, I guess he sensed that it would be, but.
Well, and that's the sense that I had in from people who, I think there is a tremendous fear of suffering. It's a way that takes away dignity and that strips you of who you are and your value. I mean, that we can talk about certain kinds of suffering, suffering on the behalf of others, certain roles that suffering might play, but the kind of suffering that's so radical that strips away every sort of human dignity, I think is, at least that's my greatest fear,
Well, I had cancer 5 years ago, and five surgeries and chemotherapy, and my experience of that was watching my body not be mine. So there's that incredible sense of
loss.
Well, loss, but more abandonment, a sense of panic about this partner is no longer partnering the way I have expected it to, and almost a sense of separation from, and then relearning how to partner with my body as I became healthy again.
Now, I think all those kinds of experiences give us deep physical, emotional connections about what evil and suffering might be. I want to move just a little bit. We have about 15 minutes left to talk about how we might respond to evil and what the tradition says. So far, we've left it at a very descriptive level. And I did that intentionally. And I want to just mention that for a minute. Traditional approaches to the problem of evil in philosophy, or what we can describe as theodicy, that is, how can a good and all-powerful God, why is there evil in the world? That's kind of the traditional formulation of the problem. very often the solutions that are offered are highly speculative. And if you've read Aquinas and Anselm and, you know, Boethius and all the people that, and then contemporary thinkers, I have my students read a book that presents like five different solutions to the problem of evil. Now the danger with that, I think, and feminist theologians have been challenging this, is that somehow if you get caught up in the conceptuality of trying to solve it, you ignore the victim who's suffering. And that's that question, that's that quote I just read again from Farley. No conceptual scheme can really thoroughly, she says, expel the bewilderment that suffering evokes. So the danger was starting and trying to figure out, well, who is God and where is God in the world, and beginning with theological abstractions, I think, is not as helpful as bringing it to the concrete description, saying, my 23-year-old daughter died. Now what am I going to say about God in the world? Instead of saying, what am I going to do with God in the world, and then bringing it down to the problem. A lot of theologians, thinkers today are saying we need to reverse our methodology of dealing with evil. So starting with conceptual abstractions, we need to start with the concrete data and figure out what evil is from there. And by doing that this morning, I think we got a little bit richer description about what evil might be and some distinctions that were pretty helpful. And that's very different than starting with giant philosophical conceptualities. So that's part of the reason I just did that methodologically. The second one has some responses to evil. These are very brief quotes. I've only listed three. There's, and I want to get some more from you, but I found Dillard a little bit helpful at this point. One response, she said, would be that Christianity somehow responds to evil by saying that the God who is involved in this world somehow loves us, and that that's a paradox. It's very hard to put that in words. And she says, only some deeply grounded and fully paradoxical view of God can make sense of the notion that God knows and loves each of 5.9 billion of us. I mean, that just sort of, it seems to say God loves everybody, but it is a mystery. It's a paradox. It's, I mean, it's a response, but I don't know that we can always figure that out. Yeah.
Well, I mean, part of that is also then grasping the paradox that God, I am the God who makes wheel and woe.
Right.
I mean, Dillard has done such a beautiful job for me of kind of reintroducing the terror possibility. If there's fear for me, there's also the fear that maybe God isn't quite as good as I would like God to be. And that there might, I don't, you know, you start to open that thing up and you start to recognize that there may be options within that. And that maybe we're casting a precious moments kind of God. That, you know, if we're really open about taking the whole of what's been revealed to us, there are some incredibly terrifying moments within that too.
With the divine,
almost a fickle nature that you're just, you know, so maybe we won't like what we see.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question for you to sort out, and I think it comes down, I really think it finally comes down to a faith commitment from yourself. She does, interestingly enough, quote that Bible verse, some of you may have to know, Isaiah 45:7. She says, the Talmud obliges people to bless evil events, griefs, and catastrophes with a special benediction. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe. For God performs everything. Isaiah 45:7. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. And we could get into a long discussion here about who God is. Some people have opened, and there's a certain discussion in Luther's theology that you can open up this notion of God that's more mysterious, more complex, that they maybe even be at least mysterious, if not fearful, side to who God is. I finally come down theologically where I can't buy that, but that's where I come down theologically. I finally have had to come down theologically and saying God is against, in every sort of way, the kind of evil, because I think any time we somehow drag God into somehow sanctifying it, then it's easier for human beings to say, well, maybe God somehow involved in that, so it's somehow okay. I know that's not what you're talking about at all, but clearly, even if she says nothing else, we can say that God, that the mystery about evil opens up a sense of a larger, who is God in the midst of all this? And that scripture passage is really interesting. I don't know exactly what to do with that, but I think there are also others which say neither, you know, Romans 8, which talks about there is nothing in all of life, death, principalities, whatever, that can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. And that's, you know, if I took one passage in Scripture that's my rock bottom fundamental commitment, it would be that passage, that no matter what happened, one would try somehow to say that God is finally with us. Yeah, Jan?
I don't know anyone who has been hurt or is suffering mm-hmm. at the hands of evil who can say that they enjoy hearing. Now, God has something in mind for you here. You know, right. In time you will learn what that is. Mm-hmm. It's not a comforting phrase.
No, it isn't. And
but on the other hand, Paul also says something about my strength is made perfect in weakness. Yeah. Now that I can buy, you
right.
know, just on the human level.
Sure.
After a while, one understands
mm-hmm.
that only those who know what it is to be weak and vulnerable develop strength.
Yeah.
That's more of a matter of character, I guess, or character formation.
Mm-hmm.
That God has something to do with, but I cannot believe that God inflicts these evils on us purposefully in order for us to build.
To build character.
Yeah.
I think it's very different. I try to put it in the language that you are, which is the saying, it's very different to say that God inflicts or causes evil. I mean, especially when you put it into parental language, then that's why we have books like Bastard Out of Carolina, where people are making good theological reasons for abusing their children. Then if you go through something that builds your character, out of which you learn something, that to say somehow God is working in that in such a way that something is changing, transforming that event,
mm-hmm.
that's very different than to say God is causing it, sort of zapping you so that, you know. And the other phrase in here, and this is just a very short quote from Dillard, says exactly what you did. She said, many times in Christian churches, I've heard the pastor say to God, all your actions show your wisdom and love. Each time I reach in vain for the courage to rise and shout, that's a lie, just to put things on solid footing. I mean, you know, so another way of responding is protest.
Maybe we should do that in church a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since I was a little girl,
yeah.
I felt like standing up in the middle of the sermon and shouting something out loud.
Yeah. Well, and that's, there's a wonderful book that raises those questions called The Trial of God by, I mean, some of you are talking about Elie Wiesel, it's a three-part play that raises this whole question about protest. It's a very biblical notion, sort of the fist in the face. For one thing, I think that moves us to the final sort of comment here, which is theological responses for me that, again, continue to do nothing but intellectualize or to put God as the one who's inflicting it, I think are all problematic. Somehow, for me, the most helpful, and this is the Ann Peterson responses, you can take these or leave these, are theological responses to evil which offer resistance to evil. How do we move against evil so that we're not complicit with it, or so that we don't sentimentalize it, or we don't justify it or sanctify it? I think the church has been, we're good at that. I mean, I think we find all kinds of ways to legitimize, to sanctify, to say, well, it's going to be for the greater good. But I think we're much less good at finding ways to resist God.
The yeah. classic thing is to for the church to vote as an assembly for a study.
Right.
I mean, that is our least responsible.
Lutherans are good at that, and if we had a whole another hour, I'd like to get Jim in on that discussion as an ethicist to make comments about how we the whole question of ethics and evil. Wendy Farley's book that I've quoted in here is a helpful issue, but that just raises all kinds of questions. And one person that I listed up here, I'm going to come back to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but
yeah.
I'm going to just leave with a little. How many of you have read Nikos Kazantzakis? Anybody? Last Temptation of Christ, Report to Greco. Anybody read Saviors of God?
I think so.
It's not a real well-known little book. I picked it up one time, And Kazantzakis was a Greek author. I think he died in 1957. He was never officially buried, if I understand right, by the Orthodox Church. He was considered heretical enough that they didn't finally bury him in an Orthodox way. But I found his theology provocative, and I want to just use one little quote from him. In his book, Saviors of God, he comes up with the notion that it's not only we who need saved, but it's God that needs saved. And what he calls us to be, I used the language yesterday of being cooperators with God, he calls us to be co-saviors with God. That God's, and he's using this in a very metaphorical way, that God's reputation's at stake. The God, at least, who is the one that we've talked about in classical theism, is the God who causes, inflicts suffering. That's the God that we need to save. In other words, we're responsible for perpetuating a notion of God that allows us to inflict evil, or that allows us to just have studies when we should be doing something against the evil. So I'm going to just read this little section. He said, "My God struggles on without certainty. Will God conquer? Will God be conquered? Nothing in the universe is certain. God flings himself into uncertainty. He gambles all his destiny at every moment. He clings to warm bodies. He has no other bulwark. He shouts for help. He proclaims a mobilization through the universe. It is our duty, on hearing his cry, to run under his flag, to fight by his side, to belong or to be saved with him. God is imperiled. He is not almighty, that we may cross our hands waiting for certain victory." See, you can see what his problem is. If we say, well, God, you know, will do everything, everything will work out, all I have to do is sit on the sidelines. It's Elie Wiesel's Your Face of Indifference. He is not all holy, that we may wait trustingly for him to pity and save us. Within the province of flesh, all of God is imperiled. He cannot be saved unless we save him with our own struggles, nor can we be saved unless he is saved. That's a very purposely provocative passage. You can see why the Orthodox theologians of his time probably didn't like Elie Wiesel. I mean, didn't like Kazantzakis. To say that somehow God needs to be saved seems almost blasphemous. And yet his language is pretty provocative, isn't it? And I purposely use that a lot with students and with preaching to just provoke us to think about the God that some of us have grown up with, the God who allows us to sit and be indifferent, to be on the waiting lines, that's a God that may need redeemed. In 1960s, in the Time magazine, it came out, remember which issue that was? God is Dead. That's the God that Kazantzakis is talking about, the God, the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-determining God, that the God of classical theism is dead. No.
Is that at all what Meister Eckhart is saying in God Save Us from God?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's also, I think, Luther's notion of God rescuing, God, the God in Jesus rescuing us from what he calls the hidden God, the Deus Absconditus. Yeah. I think that's exactly it. And Bonhoeffer, I have the quote on your page. I think he does the same thing. He's very critical of classical theism. That is, he talks about the God in the skies, the God who allows us again to stay on the sidelines. I'm assuming most of you know who Bonhoeffer is, the German theologian who was martyred by the Nazis. And he said, here is the decisive difference between Christianity and all religions. Our religiosity makes us look in distress to the power of God in the world. That is the God of the Deus ex machina, the God sort of out there. The Bible, however, directs man to God's powerlessness and suffering. Only the suffering God can help. To that extent, we may say that the development toward the world's coming of age outlined above, which has done away with a false conception of God, opens up a way of seeing the God of the Bible, who wins power and space in the world by weakness and suffering. I think Kazantzakis and Bonhoeffer were kindred spirits. It's not that Kazantzakis is saying that somehow God's salvation depends on us, but it's this false conception of God. The God that has been used to legitimize, to sanctify, to sentimentalize evil, and consequently, I think, to legitimize our notion that we're somehow passive in the face of evil. And what they're saying is that needs thrown out. That God is dead. that the God we find in Christianity, or as Bonhoeffer says in the Bible, comes as a God who resists suffering. That's why I'm really nervous about atonement theories, which say, well, it was God who really wanted Jesus to die. That's dangerous language on my, I think, when we do that kind of thing. Somehow, then God's on the side of suffering and death. Why would there be a resurrection then? It wouldn't make any sense. Somehow in the resurrection, you get a sense that there's resistance, overcoming of suffering and death.
And yet so intimately tied with obedience and a sense of patience and trust. It's really very difficult for us humans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yet some of the people that I learn about suffering from are those who have been patient and somehow have made it through, and you learn resurrection then takes on a little bit different place. Yeah. We have just a couple minutes. Any last chance?
This morning in his Bible study, Dan Erlander said, thank goodness God shows he can change his mind, or I don't know if he probably didn't use that pronoun.
Practical.
You know, that is a marvelous thought, and what would our God be if God were capable of changing with, let's say, the history of the world?
Right.
And it's really marvelous, I think, this emphasis now on our creating scripture through our stories. I mean, why don't we believe more in the power of our own stories to shape our lives?
Right. Well, I'm going to put a plug in for Nancy Romanoff's session tonight. That's what she's getting at, is the power of her own myth and story and the fact that we still own those and what we can do with them. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's what feminist theology is saying, the same thing, isn't
right.
it? Yeah.
So,
yeah, well, and I think, but so was Luther. Mm-hmm. I just have to end with this one little anecdote from this morning. I had a great experience. Ron Osborne, who's been working now on the staff, came to me and he showed me a new book from Joan Chittister, which is a little 5 or 6 sentence reflection for each day of the year. And I just happened to open it to June 10th and was reading it. And it said something like, the greatest sin is to not allow questioning and doubt into the world. And so she said, therefore, we should thank God for Martin Luther, thank God for Galileo, and thank God for feminists. She sort of swept Galileo, Martin Luther, feminists in the same category and said, aren't these the heroes of our faith, those who radically questioned and came out on the other side? So I think your story is really appropriate.
What a triumph.
Right. Isn't that great? I'll have to remember that. That's probably my Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. I could put Galileo, Lutheran, and feminists together. Okay. Well, we didn't nearly get to everything we could. I hope this just offered, again, what this usually is just a complete enigma. But I think we got some clarification. Your stories and discussions were helpful to me. Tomorrow we'll finish the session with one I've called Motive, which is the little 4 or 5 note thing you play in the Bach invention that keeps repeating itself over its very particularity. So tomorrow's the question of God's universality and particularity, the tension that raises. And we're going to look at that particularly in the question of how we might expand or challenge or broaden the notion of what we mean by sacrament. So we'll look at those tomorrow. Okay? All right, thank you.